This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Over the last 80 years, research has been at the core of scientific and technological progress in our societies, and universities have played and continue to play a critical role in this process. At Columbia University, research offers a critical pathway to build new knowledge and practical solutions that impact people's lives in significant ways. From batteries that produce energy cheaply and efficiently, to ultrasound technology that can help treat cancer, and tiny hearing aids that can be implanted under the skin, breakthroughs by scientists and researchers at Columbia are making critical contributions to society and the common good. Today, Vis-a-Vis is privileged to welcome someone who is at the heart of research ventures at Columbia University, Professor Jeanette Wing. Professor Wing is the Executive Vice President for Research and Professor of Computer Science at Columbia University. She joined Columbia in 2017 as the inaugural Avanesians Director of the Data Science Institute. From 2013 to 2017, she was a corporate vice president of Microsoft Research. Professor Wing's current research focus is on trustworthy AI. Her general research interests are in the areas of trustworthy computing, security and privacy, concurrent and distributed systems, programming languages, and software engineering. Professor Wing, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
We're very privileged to have you among us. You once said that research pushes the boundary between what we know and don't know. It's the cornerstone of any great university to seek, create, and disseminate new knowledge, end of quote. True research, in other words, means moving into unknown territories. In a world that is driven by results, bottom lines, turnkey solutions, how do you create the conditions for new knowledge? How do you ensure that there is space for researchers to move into the unknown and, you know, run the risk of not finding anything or discovering something they didn't set out to seek?
Thank you for that question. I actually believe that academia has a unique role in the research enterprise. This started, of course, with your reference to 80 years ago, Vannevar Bush's Endless Frontiers memo, which in fact created the National Science Foundation. And it's through that memo and the creation of the National Science Foundation that the United States has enjoyed such a flourishing research enterprise where we balance academia, government, and industry. And it's this ecosystem that I think is the pride of the United States and is why the U.S. attracts talent from around the world to come and work in our labs and study among the greatest in research. And it really is the envy of many other countries. It is a delicate balance. And the reason I want to point out this ecosystem is that we each sector needs each other. So let's start with academia. Academia is about producing talent, which produces ideas. So we nourish the talent, young talent, older talent, who produce the ideas that might lead into new technologies, new industries, startups. These ideas then go to industry. Industry can execute on those ideas. They can scale them up, they can implement them for their customers in a way that academia could not. Industry also produces a place for workforce, so the talent then goes to industry, and industry hires the talent. The talent does all sorts of great things and pays taxes that go to the government. And it's through the government funding, for instance, through taxes, that feeds the research enterprise in academia. So there's a nice loop. It's a feedback loop. So academia very much today, and still does, depend on federal funding for its research. Unlike industry, academia's mission really is about pursuit of knowledge and dissemination of knowledge. It is not about bottom line. Industry definitely is about bottom line, and I worked in industry, and I know very much the difference between research in industry and research in academia. And so we in academia have both the privilege and the responsibility to be doing what I call basic long-term research. Some of this basic long-term research is really curiosity-driven. That's a bit of a trite term, but it really means that it's a question that grabs the researcher. The researcher wants to pursue this question for the pure sake of knowing the answer. Along the way, in pursuing the answer to this question, very often byproducts come out that have direct impact on society. So the idea is one role of research in academia is to pursue those directions that are coming out of pure curiosity, pure interest from the researcher, with the goal of actually hoping to answer the question, but the side effects or the byproducts in answering that question can lead to so many concrete, tangible benefits for society. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind of research that is done in academia, really about focusing on long-term curiosity-driven. But another kind of research that's done in academia that's it's what I would call problem-driven. There's a problem to solve, and in fact, where academia, again, differs from industry is the academic will identify a problem that people don't even know today is a problem. So that's the long-term nature. So I'm thinking 10 years out, what is the problem that we in society are going to face, and how are we going to have, by the time the problem comes, a solution in place? That, again, is the long-term nature of the kind of research we do in academia. And so that is problem-driven. It's not so much curiosity-driven, but it's still long-term. And in order to achieve, in order to make progress on those kinds of problem-driven research goals, you still need the slow, steady, deliberate focus of the researcher on, I have this long-term goal and I need to make progress towards achieving that goal. So that is the nature of the research in academia. It's typically very basic, fundamental, and long-term in nature. It's not about bottom line. Academia, after all, is not about making money, whereas industry, it's about making money. It's not about what research question am I going to address that's going to help the business. That's more of a kind of question that a researcher in industry, industrial research lab, would ask and answer. So, and we can talk more about that. But the important picture I want the audience to understand is this delicate balance among academia, industry, and government. We all need each other. And we all, in the past 80 years, as you're saying, have worked so well together to create this research ecosystem. And it's been incredibly successful. It's paid off in spades for the world and certainly for the country.
So let's dig into the issue of the relationship with the private sector, with that side of the equation that you mentioned. And I want to just mention an example of a recent launch of the Columbia Fusion Research Center, which by accelerating the development of fusion energy science will help provide a sustainable and scalable energy source, we hope, for the benefit of society. And the director of this center, Carlos Paz Solden, explains that the center will engage with the fusion private sector and nurture mutually beneficial relationship with the industry. How will this work in detail? What does that actually mean when there is this dialogue with the private sector? What kind of input do researchers get from the private sector? And perhaps can you give other examples of how Columbia researchers work in close partnership with the private sector to provide solutions that benefit society?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a commonplace for universities and industry to work together. And certainly at Columbia, we do that often. First of all, in the engineering school, of course, we have many, many examples of this where we've had a longstanding relationship as a university with IBM. They have funded research in blockchain and data privacy. They are now funding research in sustainable computing. We also have a relationship with Amazon that funds AI activities. We have a recent relationship with Dream Sports that funds sports analytics. And we have many, many relationships with our sectors in New York City, like with the finance industry, with retail. You know, being in New York City, we have the advantage of being able to partner with companies in almost every sector. And the relationship specifically on fusion is interesting because a lot of the activity is actually happening in the private sector. There's a lot less funding, federal funding for fusion. And so academia has to partner with industry to have a place for solutions to land, but also to make sure that the problems we're working on are relevant. I think the advantage of working with industry from the get-go is you have the ability to transfer your results to the private sector more quickly. And I think that's quite important, especially in nuclear fusion and nuclear energy, because there's so much interest now in alternative sources of energy. And the industry is moving very quickly. And so this opportunity, a phenomenal opportunity for academia and industry to be working together in this space. The other reason that industry and academia partner well together is, of course, talent. We are training next generation talent in whatever industry you're thinking of, be it in nuclear fusion or in pharmaceuticals or in big tech. And we can't pump out enough talent in some areas. And so industry looks to us to make sure that we feed that pipeline. And it's talent at all levels, at the undergraduate level, the master's level, the PhD level. So for instance, we just recently started a master's program in quantum. And that's because industry is interested in being more proficient in quantum. They don't have the talent themselves, but they're looking to academia to produce that talent. They don't need PhDs in physics or in quantum, but they do need master's level technical expertise. And so that's another example of where industry and academia can work well together, because we can provide the education and training for that industry's needs in terms of talent.
So the two are really complementary in the way in which you're describing things. One question to go back to the sort of curiosity and long-term thinking that that you were describing. How can that process in research be beneficial also to industry?
And that's a great question, because industry does not have the luxury of thinking long term. They do have a bottom line. To them, long term is 1 year, maybe two at most. And that's not even enough time for academia to really get things started, because first you need to hire the graduate students and then train the graduates and so forth. So what industry can do in working with academia is, as I mentioned earlier, academia can anticipate what the problems of the future are going to be. We can look ahead. we can help industry be prepared for when those problems actually become real problems for industry. And so it's another beautiful complementary relationship where academia actually likes to work on long-term problems that have a long-term impact and nature and solution or long-term horizon, but also where industry just cannot. So the companies that like to work with academia are the ones who like to look into the future and like to be prepared. And so academia, it's a perfect kind of complementary relationship.
What you seem to be identifying here also is a very specific set of skills that academics and researchers have, which is to look into the future and to look into the more or less distant future.
There's another aspect of this that I think you would appreciate, which is we can take the risk.
Right.
Academics like taking risks. We can take the risk. We can start working on a problem and see where it goes. And if it fails, we can move into a different direction or we can backtrack and try something else. Industry does not have that luxury of being able to take those kinds of risks.
Right.
So they have to be more risk averse, whereas academia has the freedom to try lots of different directions. And, you know, people talk about high risk, high return. Well, you hope for those kinds of wins.
Right, right. And sometimes it's necessary, particularly when the future is uncertain, that you are.
Well, the other thing, not only is the future uncertain, but the other thing that I've learned in my own industry is that technology changes very quickly.
Right.
So, again, in academia can adapt much more quickly than industry to new technologies. Mm-hmm. So when AI first hit the street, academia was there.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of pursuing the advances in AI and using the advances in AI, but in research environment, but just operationally, we'll try it out ourselves. It's harder for industry to do that, especially a large corporation. Academia has the advantage of being able to take those kinds of risks as new technologies, you know, develop and evolve very, very quickly.
Maybe turning our attention, this is really, really fascinating, and I want to turn our attention to, you know, some of the benefits that research, that this long-term research and this risk invested research can provide to society. And I'm for example amazed by the work of many researchers in our medical school, including Columbia Professor of Surgery David Kalfa, who along with a New York Presbyterian doctor performed a rare heart procedure that helped save the lives of three children in New York at the same time. The innovative procedure involves performing a heart transplant on one child and then using the valves of her old heart to repair the hearts of two other children. And, you know, I mean, this is just to me, who, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, obviously, and this is just mind-boggling. So when it comes to impacting the wider community, what other examples come to mind that you know, Columbia researchers have generated?
I'll give you two examples. One has to do with a very new effort in cell therapy and cell engineering. The idea in cell therapy is, and cell engineering is, in this particular case, you've probably heard of immunotherapy for treating cancer, for instance. It's using the patient's own cells to help cure the disease that the patient has. And you can, you know, there are techniques that people are using, CAR T cells and so on, that people have been doing for many years. And now people are thinking about engineering cells to be personalized to treat that person's specific case of, say, cancer. This is really state of the art. This is cutting edge. And this is you know, among the many, many projects that we have at Columbia University focused on cancer. But the whole idea of cell therapy and cell engineering is a brand new thrust. Another example I wanted to share with you also from the medical school is in fighting Alzheimer's disease. So here again, we have world's experts at Columbia who have discovered a genetic variant that reduces the odds of developing Alzheimer's disease by up to 70%. And they could be using this technique for protecting thousands of people in just the United States from this disease. Popping up a level, of course, we have the Zuckerman Mind Brain Behavior Institute, which looks at neuroscience from the brain all the way to the cognitive behavior of people. And that's a world-class and unique center or institute that we have at Columbia. And I will mention this later when we talk about AI. Those are just examples, you know, coming from our medical school. We also, of course, have 17 schools at Columbia. Some of them are very research intensive. We have a world-class School of Public Health, the Mailman School of Public Health, which really looks at how to improve the health of populations of people, looking at infectious diseases, epidemiology. In fact, back to our medical school, we have world-class experts in HIV, AIDS, vaccines, and looking at immunology, infectious disease, and so on. But I should also mention we have incredibly deep science that is done in our arts and sciences school. So we have a unique collaboration between arts and sciences and engineering and quantum. It's a quantum initiative. We have world-class experts in astronomy and astrophysics. Our provost is an astrophysicist who looks for neutrinos. We're also have a growing interest at the intersection of chemistry and biology, so chemical biology. In fact, often when you look at where advances in science or engineering and medicine are made, it's at the intersection of disciplines. So it's very interesting to see how new disciplines actually evolve from two disciplines coming together. For instance, we have a very strong effort in computational biology.
And uses AI as well? In this
well,
context?
Right now, obviously, it's using AI as well.
Perhaps because this is also your area of expertise and responsible AI, I'm wondering in terms of research at Columbia University and the way in which Columbia University inserts itself into the ecosystem of AI research with industry and with other partners. What are the inspiring projects that you have seen come out of Columbia research in recent years?
Well, this is a great opportunity for me to do a little bragging about some of the recent big centers that Columbia has won, in particular from the National Science Foundation. It's very, very hard to get one of these centers. They're very competitive, and the selection process usually takes years. So a few years ago, we won a National Science Foundation Science and Technology Center, which I've always considered as the gold ring of NSF, because they only award three every few years. And we got one, and it's for AI and climate. It's called LEAP, which stands for Learning the Earth Through AI and Physics. And the idea is not to use just AI and not just to use physics, but to combine them to actually do better modeling of the Earth and understanding of the Earth. And there are two points that I wanted to make about their mission. First, you know, we basically know how to predict weather pretty well the next few days, the next couple of weeks. In the past, the climate models that we've had to predict, you know, what the Earth is going to look like has basically done predictions on the order of hundreds of years. LEAP wants to look at that sweet spot of 40 years out, 50 years out, because that will make a difference to us. That will make a difference to our children. And if we can do better prediction of what the climate will be or what the Earth will look like in 20, 30, 40 years, then maybe we can put some policies in place that would make sense for bettering society. So one challenge of our current models is that as we understand the physics and play out and simulate, you know, the world and the physics underlying all these systems, we introduce many degrees of uncertainty. So the longer out you look, the larger that uncertainty cone. The hope with LEAP is to use machine learning and data science and advanced AI to reduce the uncertainty in all the different ways that uncertainty is brought in these models.
Right.
So that's a very concrete scientific goal, which has the long-term benefit of actually doing, if you will, shorter-term prediction for the Earth.
And I should mention that we interviewed as part of Vis-a-Vis Pierre Gentil.
Excellent.
Yes.
Very good.
Right.
I expect no less.
Right.
So that's one example. Mm-hmm. Another example of a recent win that Columbia has in AI is AI and neuroscience. So we recently won a National Science Foundation AI Institute, and it's called ARNI, and it stands for Artificial and Natural Intelligence. And the idea is, again, bidirectional. As you probably know, many of the current advances in AI are based on deep neural networks. And the word neural in there is key because these networks originally were inspired by the way our brain looks, which is a bunch of neurons connected together. And it's really just a metaphor because these deep neural networks are just layers and layers of nodes connected together. It's not what our brain looks like.
Right.
The idea in one direction is to see if we can use more faithful representations of our brain to see if that could inspire more detailed computational models that actually might mimic the way in which our human brain learns and affects intelligence. So that's one direction. Use our brain to inspire new models in AI. Now, the other direction is more obvious, which is use the data that we use for instrumenting our brain and get all the imaging and so on, and use AI techniques to actually do the analysis of that data, and then better understand our brain through that analysis. That is obviously more, that is doable. It's
right.
Just a matter of scale.
Right. And, I mean, in terms of taking inspiration from how our brain functions, as you were mentioning, is there also an energy benefit there? Because I understand that our brain is very efficient in terms of what it produces, as opposed to AI, which tends to consume.
Right, and I think one hopes that the kind of AI models that we produce in the future, in some sense, can be smaller. They don't have to be so large and consume so much energy in order to be built. But again, that is definitely our brains are very energy efficient and our AI models are not.
Right.
So it'd be good if we can find a way to make our AI models more energy efficient and smaller in representation.
So I want to turn to the work that you do specifically for the benefit of the entire Columbia community. You, as the executive vice president of research, run, you know, one of the largest university research operations in the world. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you work? And you know, say I'm a nuclear physicist. I mean, that's nothing like me. But let's say I'm a nuclear physicist and I want to apply for a grant from a major U.S. foundation. What kind of support would you give me?
Okay, that's a great question. I like to think about my office of the Executive Vice President for Research as having two roles. The first is to help the research community develop their ideas, help them with writing grants, help them find opportunities for the ideas they have. We worked our office serves the entire university, but we work very closely with the individual schools. And what our office does best is connect the dots. So what one school cannot do on its own, we can help find the partners. We can help connect faculty from different schools together, for instance, to go after a big center grant. We do this routinely, and this is something that the faculty very much appreciate because it's very, for the large university like Columbia, it's hard enough to find people outside your department within the same school, but it's even harder to find faculty in other schools. And so our job is to help faculty find each other and then to help build these collaborative teams so they can go after these big center scale grants. And that's, we've been quite successful in the recent years. We are especially looking for new ways for our faculty to partner with other academic institutions, with industry, with foundations, with nonprofits, with universities international collaborations. We're especially interested in more partnerships and more collaborations beyond the walls of Columbia today. So my office handles a lot of that. And there are two projects that I have personally been involved with in the past few years. One is the work to help create the Chan Zuckerberg Biohub in New York City. And this is a partnership with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, Rockefeller University, and Yale University, and Columbia University. So these four partners have come together to create this nonprofit entity called the Chan Zuckerberg New York City Biohub. It's a $250 million funded effort over 10 years, and it has a grandiose vision, scientific vision, of being able to engineer our immune system to help treat disease. And this goes back to what I was talking about before about cell engineering and cell therapy. There are only three biohubs in the United States, and I was very proud to be able to help New York City and land this one with Columbia as a partner. The second big effort that I'm still working on is something called Empire AI. Have you heard about this?
No.
Okay. Empire AI is a partnership with New York State and six universities and the Simons Foundation. And it's partly funded by New York State, the six universities, the Simons Foundation, and private donors. Its goal is to build a huge GPU cluster, which will be in Buffalo. And the state, along with the universities, are funding this 10-year effort on the order of $450 million. And we are hoping that we'll be able to get more money and with possibly new partners. There is nothing like this anywhere in the world.
Right.
Where universities and the state have come together to build a computational power that will benefit each of the academic partners to do research in AI. No one university can afford this. Mm-hmm. But by coming together, and obviously with state money, we can actually hope to provide the academic community with computational resources to do advanced AI in a way they cannot today. Now, I should say that $450 million is peanuts compared to what big tech companies put into their data centers to do AI. Mm-hmm. But the difference is nothing or something.
Right.
And this is something. Mm-hmm. And already this Empire AI is a brand new effort. We are 18 months ahead of schedule, thanks to the generosity of the Simons Foundation. We are already running jobs from the six universities on an alpha version of Empire AI, already making new discoveries in science, in engineering, advancing AI itself. So it's going great guns. And we're hoping to launch beta by the end of the summer. And this is another effort that I had personally been involved in as EVPR for Columbia, because I'm representing Columbia at the table.
That's wonderful. That's really very inspiring as well.
But there's another part of my office that is in charge of ensuring that we set the right university-wide policies, and we ensure that we want to make sure that the faculty know what the policies are and follow and comply with the policies. As you know, research in the United States is highly regulated, so many of the federal funding agencies have many rules and policies and regulations, and we need to make sure that our faculty know what those rules and policies and regulations are. Some of the major areas where we are actually required by law to make sure that we have offices to handle are in human subjects research and in research with animals.
This is wonderful, Professor Wing. I mean, you've given us such a broad overview and of the scale and scope of research at Columbia University, and so many insights as well about the work that you do. Thank you very much. We're very grateful for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris 1 Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Rachel Kahn and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Esther Jackson and her colleagues at Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.